ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And this is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day, welcome to the program. My name's Fiona Broom. Lovely to have your company this Friday lunchtime. The swags are rolling out at the Borroloola Bushmen's Carnival. The camp draft is entering its final days. The rodeo riders are getting ready for their events. Before 1:30, I'll take you to the Bushmen's Carnival. Also ahead on the show, I'll tell you about what's happening in the live export trade of a very different kind.
We do four or five small shipments of live animal export every year, and we've just got a big 200 head shipment headed for China in about mid to late September. So it's been a busy time on farm.
I can tell you that producer isn't talking about cattle. You'll find out what she's sending to China ahead on the program. And canola. Australian canola producers are inching closer to an agreement with China. All that and more coming up on the Country Hour. Let's get into it. Just a reminder, if you've missed any programs this week or if you need to duck out during today's program, you can catch up on every episode of the Country Hour on the ABC Listen app or anywhere you get your podcasts. Let's begin today's program with meat processing. Smaller scale livestock producers right across the country are rapidly losing access to meat processors and to service kill space. And a local food advocacy group wants regulations changed to allow more community or micro abattoirs to set up. Jesse Power is the general coordinator of AFSA, the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance. Jesse, welcome to the Country Hour. How difficult is it for smaller scale producers around Australia to get access to abattoirs and abattoir space? Is that sector shrinking?
Yeah, definitely, Fiona. AFSA has actually flagged this as a national crisis. So we've just released a report that looks at the lack of access to service kills across the country. And what the national snapshot is telling us is that the remaining abattoir footprint across Australia demonstrates a rapid and ongoing decline. So we're looking at 50 abattoirs which have closed in the last 10 years alone across all states and territories, and less than 30% of those remaining abattoirs provide access to service kills. With increasing restrictions on access. So it's a huge issue, not only for small-scale producers, but also to medium-scale producers as well.
And what's the scenario in the Northern Territory? There's only a handful of small-scale or on-farm abattoirs in the Northern Territory.
So the situation in the Northern Territory is actually pretty dire. So what we found in that report is that no abattoirs offer service kills in the NT. The only remaining abattoirs are Rum Jungle Meat Exports and Crocodilus Park Farm, which are abattoirs servicing the export and game markets. And there's also the Indigenous Run Abattoir, which services the local community. So I would say that the Northern Territory is probably in dire need of micro abattoirs on farm to service local producers.
And why do you want to see better access to abattoirs and kill space for smaller producers? Have we seen any impact on the amount of meat being processed in Australia?
Look, I think there's with the kind of consolidation of this processing infrastructure, it's going the same way as the dairy industry in the 2000s. And what we're seeing is an increasing export focus. So international ownership and vertical integration of those processing facilities. And that really leads to kind of uneven market power, which means there's fewer options for farmers seeking to grow and retain control of how to sell their meat and assure quality and animal welfare. So it's a massive issue, not only for producers, but also for butchers, for chefs, for eaters who want access to local ethical meat where they know, you know, how the animals are raised, where it comes from, and has kind of less of an environmental impact as well.
What's been going on in Victoria with on-farm abattoir planning regulations?
So in Victoria, we've actually just won a really huge planning reform that will enable small-scale producers to build micro-abattoirs on-farm. That's been about 8 years in the making since AFSA first proposed it to state government. And it's really critical because it recognises slaughter as an ancillary use in rural and agricultural zones. So although producers will need may need a building permit to build that, they won't need a planning permit. And that's really crucial because processing is intrinsic to livestock farming. So just kind of breaking down that barrier for small-scale producers to be able to build these on-farm facilities is really crucial. So we're asking all state governments to follow suit and recognise micro-abattoirs as ancillary use in those zones.
Would loosening any regulations in this space pose any risk to animal welfare standards or to environmental and food safety?
Absolutely not. What we found is that, all of those issues, animal welfare, food safety standards are far higher in industrial agriculture, particularly industrial livestock agriculture. Small scale producers will still follow the same rigorous food safety standards. A lot of our AFSA members are pastured livestock farmers, so animal welfare is key to their operations. So there would be, no risk there.
And does local processing or on-farm processing, does that offer an additional revenue stream for livestock producers, a sort of value adding to their business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of, cost prohibitive barriers to farming as it stands. So having access to, local community infrastructure that can be, shared amongst producers really does alleviate that kind of cost burden of travelling, up to 500 kilometres to their nearest abattoir, which is what is happening for a lot of AFSA members at the moment. We did a survey earlier in the year that said that 80% of producers have lost access to their local abattoir in the past few years and are having to travel up to 500 kilometres to their nearest abattoir. So it really does reduce that burden for them.
Have there been any success stories in this space anywhere in Australia? Has anyone regained some of that local processing?
Yeah, absolutely. There are quite a few projects happening at the moment. The micro abattoir being built at Jonai Farms and Meat Smiths, which is based in Daylesford, Victoria. So they're currently in the process of setting up an on-farm micro abattoir that will service local communities, so a number of producers in the region. And there's also a few others, so looking at Grazed and Grown in New South Wales, which is servicing local community, and Meredith Micro Abattoir as well. So Meredith Dairy has also set up a micro operation that services the local community.
What do you actually need to do to establish a small-scale abattoir? What are the regulatory hurdles, and what are some of the costs or the staffing issues that people might face?
So I guess the first barrier, again, is to go back to that need for planning legislation to interpret a micro-abattoir as ancillary use in the rural and agricultural zones. And what that does is exempt development that does not require a planning permit. We also are recommending to state governments that they establish working groups in each state and territory, similar to what's happening in Victoria with the Victorian Access to Abattoirs Working Group. That's convened by Agriculture Victoria, and membership includes the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance and any state-based non-commodity farmers organisations. And then the other barrier that could be addressed is looking at, there are currently very few RTOs in Australia offering the requisite training for meat inspection. So that's the Certificate 3 in meat processing, which has been vertically integrated along with slaughter access. So state and territory governments should urgently address this gap with targeted policy and funding strategies. So there's a fee-free TAFE scheme at the moment to address labour shortages, and that should be kind of extended to meat processing.
Some of the challenges that the Northern Territory faces are unique to the Northern Territory. Could this micro abattoir model or community abattoir model be successful in the Northern Territory?
Yeah, absolutely. And AFSA has put together a Meat Collective Starter Pack, which is available to members. And that provides guidance on, funding a micro abattoir. How would you fund it? Through community, through grants, whatever avenue you're kind of going down. And then also the process of being approved by local government or, through state planning regulations. So these are feasible models, and they can be replicated across all states and territories. So it's just a case of looking at the unique settings within the Northern Territory and adapting it to suit the producers.
Jessie Power, thank you for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
That was Jessie Power, the General Coordinator of AFSA, the Australian Food Sovereignty Alliance. It's an interesting thing to think about. What do you think? Would you like to see more local meat processing in the Northern Territory? 0487 99 1057 is the text number. You can drop me a text through the ABC Listen app as well. 20 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. In just a moment, could new China tariffs on Canadian canola seed be good news for Australia? Stay tuned to the Country Hour. I can walk right past a stranger, a little more country. A little more country from Golden Guitar winner Max Jackson there. 16 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Lovely to have your company this Friday lunchtime. Well, the Chinese market is effectively closed to the Canadian canola industry after China announced canola seed will now be subject to a 75.8% tariff. It's pretty bad news for Canadian farmers who are just weeks off harvesting their canola crops. But Australia and China are believed to be getting close to an agreement to allow Aussie canola into the country. Analyst Andrew Whitelaw says China's move against Canadian canola could be good news for Australian growers.
About a year and a half ago, Canada started putting significant tariffs on electric vehicles from China. And so it's a bit of a tit-for-tat retaliation. And so now China has put huge tariffs on Canadian canola, which will make it unviable for Canada to send any canola over there.
We already saw some tariffs with meal, though, didn't we? This is sort of a third step that's happened.
Yeah, so we saw some tariffs on meal and oil back in, I think, March or April.
Right.
But now this is actually on the canola seed itself, which Canada was a major exporter to China.
This tariff has essentially closed the door, but how much Canadian canola was going into China?
Between about 4 and 5 million tonnes off the top of my head, but around about, basically, out of all of their exports, is around about just under half of all their exports of canola seed would go to China. So sometimes they were exporting more canola from Canada to China than our entire export program in Australia.
It's a lot of canola, isn't it? 5 million tonnes that now needs a home. What does this mean for Australian canola growers? How does it adjust who is supplying where?
We haven't been able to supply much or next to no canola for the past about 5 years because China was concerned about blackleg. Whether that was a real issue or not is another discussion for another day. But over the last year, they've been trialling shipments of canola to make sure that there was no blackleg. And that was sort of a sign to me that they were probably going to enact some form of tariff on Canadian canola. So now we've got access to China, which is good news for our canola because we've been heavily reliant on Europe. And most farmers I speak to don't like filling in those ISCC forms. This gives us another market where you don't need to fill those forms in potentially. That is a good thing. We've got this potential new market opened up for canola, for non-GM. But one of the risks we've got is that pretty much all of the canola in Canada is GM. So that's going to be competing with the market that we have for GM. And we've already seen that the GM price in Western Australia come under a lot of pressure today. And that's because the markets for GM are more limited. It's not like Canada can just switch around and say, oh, we're going to send it all to Europe. Because despite the fact that Europe wants it for turning into biodiesel, they still have to sell the meal, and the meal from GM is priced at a lower value in Europe. So it's good news and bad news, depending on how you look at it. But in the long term, pretty good news that we've got a new market open for our canola.
But then when you think about the amount of canola that Australia grows versus the 5 million tonnes that China will now be looking for, you wonder if that gap that we're seeing appearing between GM and non-GM, if that split will remain, because you would think, well, surely China would be looking for all the canola that we grow, GM or non-GM.
Yeah, and I think that's the key thing. We just need to keep a close eye on it. Like, we always have these sort of events when something happens, the market reacts. It doesn't quite know what to do. So it becomes more cautious, more risk averse. So I think it's a key thing is just to look at over it the next sort of 5-6 months. At the end of the day, there's not much left from last year. And there's not many farmers forward selling canola at this point. So it's a bit of a moot point. But in the next coming weeks, as we get closer and closer to harvest, which is only 3 or 4 months away for canola, it could provide opportunities. The more doors we have open for our canola, barley and wheat and sorghum and every other commodity, the better we are.
That's Episode 3 analyst Andrew Whitelaw speaking with Joe Prendergast. Grain Producers Australia Chair Barry Large, he agrees Australian canola growers are now in a good position to re-enter China's markets.
It gives us strength to get back into the market, regardless of what the reasons were why we weren't in the market. I think opportunity presents. I mean, Australia has a great track record of high-quality canola. We do practice good biosecurity measures in this country, and everything is produced in a sustainable way. So I certainly think opportunity is here. We want to be sending canola everywhere. The more players that we have at the table buying our canola has got to be good for Australian growers. And as an Australian grower myself, I see opportunity here at the moment to bring another buyer back into the fold.
Yeah, and Australian canola, there were reports that we were fairly close to getting canola back into China anyway. Do you know where that process is at?
Yeah, look, the government's always in ongoing talks about keeping the market access open. And yes, you're correct. There's been strong dialogue and we are very close to there. This is, I guess, another tick to hopefully give us a better chance of opening the trade back up. At the end of the day, it's supply and demand. We've got the supply and they've got the demand. So we're going to come together and hopefully we get some more canola on those ships back over to China.
Is this one of those positions where by not being involved in this trade fight between two different countries, but again, involving a large buyer in China, Australia could finally benefit?
Absolutely. I think we can benefit. I think the lessons learned from the barley issues and that was we were fortunate enough to open other doors and other markets as we've done with canola. But we certainly welcome China back and we will try and facilitate some trade. And I'll say it again, the more people that can come in the front gate of my farm wanting to buy our products, it's got to be good.
That's Grain Producers Australia Chair Barry Large speaking with Warwick Long.
Hi, I'm Brad Murray. Run Jervoy Station, sort of jack of all trades here, whatever the boss wants me to do, mainly truck driving and cattle work. You listen to the Country Hour.
Nine minutes to 1 o'clock on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Staying with exports to China, a special live export shipment will be heading that way very soon. I'm not talking about cattle. A New South Wales live exporter is fulfilling an order from China for 200 head of alpaca. Stud owner Ruby Williams told Warwick Long all about alpaca export at this year's National Alpaca Show.
We do 4 or 5 small shipments of live animal export every year, and we've just got a big 200 head shipment of alpacas headed for China in about mid to late September. So it's been a busy time on farm. So just like cattle, just like sheep, just like wherever you're going in the world, obviously you've got different countries have different protocols that you've got to meet. So for China, for example, the 200 head we've got going in a couple of months, they all need blood work done. They've all obviously got to be quarantined. But the interesting thing about alpacas, and I know live export is a very topical discussion at the moment, especially in the political sense, but alpaca exports are great. We fly. We don't go by boats.
So you'd be flying them.
They fly.
How do alpacas fly?
Oh, as far as I know, great. I'm lucky enough, I don't ever have to sit in the crate with them, but they look pretty snug and comfy when we're sealing up the crate at Sydney Airport, that's for sure.
So do the 200 go on one plane, or do you have to book them in over a certain period of time?
So obviously we've got there's a lot of logistics that go into a shipment of that size. Like the bulk of the shipments we do in comparison are between the 12 to 50 marks. So the 200 has been a massive, massive jump for us as well. It's all the same, it's just on a larger scale. So instead of one plane, they're going on, I think it's 12 double-decker crates across two planes.
Wow.
But they just go on commercial flight. You never know. Just underneath you in those cargo barracks is 150 alpacas just chilling in a crate as well.
This order from China, the 200 you're working on now, that's out of the box. That's a big order.
And it was a big thing in the industry about 10, 15 years ago. There was a lot of interest for Australian alpaca from the Chinese market, but we've had some issues with some countries and change in protocols.
Yeah.
And so the interest died off somewhat, but this 200 head is an initial trial shipment for them to be able to supply upwards of 400 animals each year until 2027. So by the end of it, we're hoping to have exported at least 1,000 alpacas over to them.
That must be exciting.
It's very cool to be sitting on the precipice of something quite big, and we're lucky enough within our herd we could support that number on our own, but we've approached it similarly to how we've approached the fibre. We've gotten in and spoken to some of the breeders around us. We're based in the Central West in New South Wales, and that's a great little alpaca community there. Mm. And we've approached them and all said, get breeding, guys. We've got contracts that can sell offspring for you in 2 or 3 years' time in advance.
That's Ruby Williams from the Surrey Alliance Alpaca Stud, speaking there with Warwick Long at the National Alpaca Show. So Ruby, about to send, in the next couple of weeks, 200 head of alpaca in a plane to China.
Do you know a young person with a story to tell?
Hey, well, has a chance to
tell our stories on a national platform.
Go to Canberra, go out, make change.
And be heard.
Enter by September 1st.
abc.net.au/haywire.
Hi, I'm Beth McGrath, and I work for the Australian Wildlife Conservancy. You're listening to The Country Hour.
Fiona Broom with you this afternoon on the Country Hour. Matt Brand having a bit of a rest this week. He will be back with you on your radio next week, though. Now, this evening on ABC Radio Darwin Drive, Liz Travascus will announce the winner of a competition to come up with a new sexual health slogan for this weekend's inaugural Darwin River Muster. You probably saw it. NT Health created a bunch of posters and coasters before the Love Muster event at the Catherine Show. They looked like posters for country and western films, but they had slogans like, even cowgirls get chlamydia, protect your posse, and saddle sore or something more, don't blame the saddle, not all rubs are from riding. The brains behind that health campaign, Arnamy Olivia and Jessica O'Connor, told Liz Travascus how it all came about.
It actually started with a very humble toilet poster. We had a nurse in Catherine alerting us to an opportunity to do posters at the toilets at the Love Muster. And we were like, we see you and we raise you. We did posters and coasters because we were like, what are we going to do with those wet bottom beers? And then did the coasters and the posters, and it went viral on social media. The public were amazing. It landed really well with the NT audience. And we couldn't be happier because it's really hard to reach target for us. You know, people are moving into the bigger cities for the masters and the rodeos, and those are the people we would like to reach.
Why did they want this messaging at the Catherine Show? There's no particular outbreak of concern, is there?
No, the request came through just as we have an opportunity. It's a Love Muster, so it's very much a cowboy, cowgirl themed. It is heart themed, it's finding love, it's people in their swags. So it was a good opportunity to punt this for us.
And were people taking them off the toilet doors and taking them home because they were just so good? Jessica,
people,
what happened?
People were stealing the posters, they were taking the coasters home. We got comments into our team, can we have them in our clinics? Can we have them at our station? So after the posts, we got 1 million views on our social media, which is just amazing for NT Health.
So you have spread the message and now you're back again with another campaign ahead of the inaugural Darwin River Muster, which is on this weekend. You can't just pump out the last round of posters. Can you tell us some of the new slogans that you've come up with?
One of the favourites that we had was when the top end meets the bottom end, and we've got boots facing top to toe. And then we've got saloon doors and it says swing both ways. And then it says, so do STIs. Yeah. So the third one that we also really liked is it's just literally the tip of a horse's face and it says just the tip. And then yes. It says, know the facts, deepen your knowledge. And all of our posters contain a scan code so you can get more information on or more knowledge on your sexual health or where to go to get condoms.
And I mean, the Darwin River Muster this weekend, it's the inaugural one. Did they contact you or you've said, we want to get more of these posters out at your event?
Yeah, we literally went to them. And when I spoke to the lady in the tavern, she said, oh, I've seen the posters, I'm on board. And that was great for us. So these posters will be up at the muster in the bathrooms with our captive audience, as you call it. So yes, we are happy to pair up with them and we'd love to, for them and for the Catherine Muster, Love Muster, team up with them again because it's such a good opportunity for us to get our message out.
That's Arnamie Olivier and Jessica O'Connor from NT Health speaking with Liz Travascus. And they did say that the campaign was a success because they had hundreds of clicks through to the sexual health website, which I guess was ultimately the point of it all. But it also creates a fair bit of fun. Liz has asked for your pictures for a poster, and there have been literally hundreds, maybe even thousands of suggestions. Arnamie and Jessica are going to pick their favourites and turn them into a poster. The winner will be announced this evening on Drive with Liz Travascus. Tune in from 4 o'clock. Here's a couple of suggestions that I've seen. Even an 8-second ride needs protection. Saddle up, partner. Always cover your gear before you steer. And put on your rubbers before rounding up scrubbers. There's a few other, perhaps too saucy ones for me to read out on radio. Coming up to 1 o'clock here on your ABC, you're about to head to the newsroom. I'll be back with you at 1:05 for a chat with the Weather Bureau. Stay tuned to the Country Hour.
I'm Emily Hoffman, and I love chasing chunky skinks in the top end. And you are listening to the Country Hour.
Welcome back to the program. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon on the Country Hour. Ahead over the next half hour, I'll take you to the Borroloola Bushmen's Carnival. Plenty of action happening over that way this weekend. We'll also check in on the locust situation in Queensland. There have been swarms of locusts in the central west for a couple of months. Locust commissioners, though, are getting concerned about what might happen in the next couple of months with those locust swarms. I will take you there very shortly on the program. Let's head now to the Weather Bureau. Rebecca Patrick with us this afternoon. G'day, Rebecca.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
How are things looking out in the Northern Territory today? Much change from yesterday?
No, very sunny conditions across the territory. Had a bit of fog around the Arnhem District this morning. And we had a trough moving through the south earlier today, but it looks like the southeasterlies have pushed through now. So just starting to get that new ridge forming across the southern areas today.
Okay. And so is that expecting to see a surge over the weekend?
Yeah, that's right. So we've got a high-pressure system that'll be moving across southern Australia over the next few days. So that'll send a surge of those southeasterly winds through the south tomorrow. So cooler conditions over southern districts, temperatures dropping about 4 to 6 degrees. And then moving up through central parts and into the top end on Sunday. So Barkly, you'll see those temperatures drop on next Sunday and might even drop a degree or two off in the top end as well.
What kind of temperatures are we talking, Rebecca?
Yeah, so for Alice Springs, 26 forecast for today. That'll drop to 20 for tomorrow. Mm. Tennant Creek, still warm tomorrow with a top of 27, but dropping to 24 on Sunday. And then up in the top end, places like Catherine, 31s on the weekend, but dropping to about 29 on Monday. So just seeing a little bit of that cool air. But probably more noticeable in the top end will be the overnight temperatures dropping a bit further as well. So mostly for next week that'll kick in.
Okay. Any severe or strong winds associated with that?
So it is a fairly strong ridge coming in. So we are expecting windy conditions, so peaking on Sunday. And across marine areas, we could see some strong wind warnings. So be mindful of that if you're getting out in the boat. Probably more likely for off the north coast and the Gulf of Carpentaria for those stronger winds. And then also those winds picking up, particularly through the Barkly, but also getting up into the top end with some fresh and gusty winds during Sunday. Usually we see those peak winds around the late morning and early afternoon, and that will be increasing our fire danger as well. So, be aware of that with potential for some warnings with the fire weather warnings as well. So look out for those.
Is that expected both Saturday and Sunday, or is Sunday still kind of the more danger day?
Yeah, Sunday's the peak day. So we'll see a bit of an increase tomorrow with that fire danger, but still just staying in that high range, but then picking up a bit more on Sunday.
Okay, and which districts, sorry, with the fire danger for Sunday?
So the Darwin-Adelaide River area, so that's a fire forecast area there, and also parts of the Barkly, we're seeing elevated fire dangers.
Okay. There is a bit of fire around at the moment. The Elsie fire, we heard from Bushfires NT yesterday, that's burnt more than 120,000 hectares. And just looking at the Bushfires NT map, the Victoria River bushfire seems to be fairly large on the map now too. How are conditions looking in those locations?
Yeah, so at the moment, looking at Tyndall, we're seeing east-southeasterly winds at the moment about 20 gusting 30 kilometres per hour. So a little bit of gusty winds there, but that will be picking up over the weekend. It's a little bit less through that Victoria River area at the moment, but again, with those winds picking up on the weekend, hopefully fire agencies will be able to get those fires under control.
And the Borroloola Bushman's Carnival, it's on at the moment. It's continuing across the weekend. Rebecca, what can people expect from their weather there this weekend?
Yeah, so lovely sunny days and dry conditions. For Borroloola, looking at 12, 13 degrees minimum temperatures, getting up to 32 on Saturday, 31 on Sunday. Do expect a bit of wind on Sunday with that surge coming through as well.
So you need a bit of a doona if you're swagging it?
Depends on your tolerance.
I'd need a doona, I reckon.
If you're coming up from, you know, Alice Springs or somewhere, then you're probably used to that. But, I would probably be needing a bit of warmth myself.
Yeah, fair enough. Anything else, Rebecca, that we should know carrying into the weekend?
No, I think that's the main things. Yeah, just keep an eye out for those warnings. But otherwise, it should be pretty sunny, nice conditions.
Radio. Thanks for your time. Have a great Friday.
No worries. Thanks, Fiona.
Rebecca Patrick at the Bureau of Meteorology there.
Hi, I'm Stephen Rose. I do aquaculture, bees and plants at Northern Plants Nursery, Edith. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Twelve minutes past 1 o'clock on The Country Hour. Fiona Broom with you this Friday lunchtime. Now, I've been keeping an eye on the locust situation in Queensland, and I've got a bit of an update for you. Migratory locusts, that's the official name of that particular type of locust, they've been growing in numbers in central west Queensland, so much so that locust commissioners now say that they could become a plague in the next couple of months. The locusts are currently about 650 kilometres east of the NT border, but once locusts reach plague levels, they can actually move hundreds of kilometres in a night. Grace Nakamura brings you more on this situation from Muttaburra.
They look like massive puffs of black smoke, and it's not till you get closer to them you realise what they are. And
on the outback horizon, a swarm is brewing.
Yeah, on the motorbikes was horrendous. You just, you know, it was like bullets hitting you, and you'd have to go really slow because they actually would hurt you if they hit you in the eyes.
Grazier Jeff Seckham is no stranger to locusts.
Yeah, I was only 9 and 10 in the 90s, but I just remember running through the garden, and it was a great game to get smashed by grasshoppers as a kid.
In the past few months, he's witnessed swarms of migratory locusts descend on his cattle and sheep station near Muttaburra, about 1,200 kilometres northwest of Brisbane. It's an outbreak that's getting worse.
Locusts will totally wipe you out. In the last 5 years, we've had locusts four times. The amount of locusts we have this year is tenfold. But they are massive swarms, and, you know, your heart just sinks. You're like, oh, do I have to go back through this again? It is a gut-wrenching feeling.
Locusts aren't usually this active in winter and in this part of Queensland. But as the Australian Plague Locust Commissioner, Dr. Bertie Henneke, explains, it's thanks to the heavy rainfall in the west earlier this year.
It's also a perfect situation for them. There's a lot of vegetation they can feed on. They can build up their strings and lay eggs. There have been now, I think, up to three or four populations that have built up on each other because, you know, eggs are hatching and building up on the next on the previous generation. So when we get to five or six populations, that's when we really have concerns about that it can turn into a bigger plague problem.
So how likely is a locust plague? It all depends on the rain.
We're looking at if every month we have around 30 mil of rain, then that is enough to keep the vegetation going and the population is likely to increase and could potentially move into, as I said before, into that sort of plague population. But if the rainfall will be below that, we see probably a similar situation that we saw in 2002 and 2015, that the locust populations are decreasing over time. So therefore, the next generation won't develop into adults.
The threat of a plague has spurred the government to action. A task force with members from the Department of Primary Industries, local council and Agforce is now meeting weekly in Longreach. State member Sean Dillon is concerned about the agricultural impact.
These locusts pose a clear threat to grazing land, to ongoing beef and sheep cattle production and goats in the central west, and that's why the department has stood up and is taking very seriously oversight of these locusts.
And time is of the essence.
As the spring hits, the expectation is that the eggs that have been laid through the winter will hatch and the swarms that we already see will become much denser, larger and more mobile. Because as bad as the locusts are now, the professional advice is that they're actually going to get much worse.
Landholders have a general biosecurity obligation to manage locusts themselves, but spraying them is expensive. The Department of Primary Industries' role is to step in once the swarm is beyond landholders' control. So far, graziers haven't received any DPI government funding to help spray, but plans are underway.
Oh, we certainly can understand the landholders' frustration.
Queensland's Locust Commissioner is Michelle Smith.
The state government, in conjunction with the federal government, have sort of just recently had a co-agreement essentially for some additional funding potentially. It will be for the department to undertake large-scale aerial control if required, and that should be delivered through the disaster management framework.
Western Queensland councils are also looking at contributing to the Pest Plague Contingency Fund. It's a fund that 19 councils in Queensland contribute to so they can access funding to spray locusts whenever there's an outbreak. Meanwhile, graziers like Jeff Secken just want government support.
I think it would cost this place, which is 85,000 acres, would cost about $60,000 to spray it. You know, it's got to be region-wide. You can't just do your place because they're just going to come in from next door. So we'd really like to see the government make some action. Don't keep flying out here trying to make decisions. It's a very easy solution. We just need a bit of help in funding to make it happen.
That's Queensland grazier Jeff Secken. He's from Kenya Station, which is just west of Muttaburra. He was ending that report from Grace Nakamura. We will keep an eye on what those swarms of migratory locusts are doing in central West Queensland.
Add some colour and life to your garden. Get tips on growing classic annuals, flannel flowers, potted fruit trees, blueberries and bird-friendly plants. It's all in Gardening Australia magazine from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
18 minutes past one on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Still to come on the program today, you'll meet a station hand who's probably travelled about as far as he possibly can to move to Central Australia to have a go at cattle work. And I'll take you to the Borroloola Bushmen's Carnival, where the swags are hitting the ground for the weekend's events. But it is Friday, so it must be time for some Troy Cassidaly. Let's Ride from Troy Cassidaly. That song from the Between the Fires album. And I actually caught Troy Cassidaly last week as part of the Darwin Festival here in Darwin. He aired his documentary about the making of that album. The documentary is called A Journey Between the Fires. And Troy played some of the songs, including that one, from the record. It was an absolutely lovely evening.
Hi, I'm Eridani Mulder. I'm a senior wildlife ecologist at the Australian Wildlife Conservancy's Wongalara Wildlife Sanctuary, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Well, many new station hands make a pretty big move when they come to work in the Northern Territory, but not many travel the 14,000 kilometres that Joe Grady covered to come and work in Central Australia. Originally from England, Joe now calls an Anningie station home, and he told Charles Geary how he found his way to the Northern Territory's beef industry.
Hi, I'm Joe Grady. I'm a station hand. I'm from England, a place called Norfolk, down south. A bit different to out here. I'm from Anningie, so that's 3 hours from Alice Springs. Been out here, I think it's 6 months now. Yeah, 6 months.
What brought you here to Central Australia? It is quite literally on the other side of the world.
Thought I'd give myself a hand at a bit of station work. Working a bit of cattle, thought it'd be good fun. Yeah, and also a bit of bull riding as well, so quite keen on that. Where a place to come, yeah.
Were you from a farm originally when you came over from England?
No, I wasn't. I've done a bit of farm work on like family friends, but yeah, dad's in property, so very different to out here.
Where did you find, I guess, that desire or that push to make you want to make that change and sort of explore that life in agriculture?
I was sort of sitting there and I was thinking, I need a bit of excitement. So I was like, had a look online, found some other guys that had done it and read up about it. And so I was like, oh, yeah, go on then, have a crack.
Tell us a bit about some of the things that you've been doing out there on the station.
So we've been doing a bit of cattle work. So, yeah, just sort of a lot of drafting, trucking, all that sort of stuff. Recently, we've been doing a lot of yard building.
Biggest shock when you came out here to Central Australia, what caught you most by surprise?
Oh, the flies. I think it's the fly. Yeah, I rocked up first day. And I was like, oh, yeah, all over your face. I was like, this is it. Yeah, I was just, yeah, I wasn't really expecting it. And then I sort of just about used to it now, but still annoying.
Did you have much experience on horseback or doing that sort of work before you came out here?
Yeah, I had a fair bit of riding experience, but not working on horses. So that was real interesting to get into, actually, like, working on horses. It really tests you sort of actually how much you think you know about riding when you've got to suddenly chase after a heifer or something.
What have you loved most about being here in Central Australia?
Oh, probably riding, actually. Yeah, doing mustering, like, on the horseback. It's just so cool to see, you know, everyone sort of around you on horses, and yeah, just unreal.
How much longer do you think Australia will have you for before you make it back, or is this maybe going to be a permanent transition here?
Oh, we'll have to see. I think I'm planning to leave in November, and then might come back for a second year. We'll have to see.
A Brit on a Bull is what we saw today. We saw you on the novice bull ride. Tell us about your experience there.
Okay. Yeah, it was exciting. I think it was probably my best ride I've done. It was my first proper rodeo. We had a practice day a few days ago. You know, sort of all right. Bit nervous. First time. But yeah, great ride. I think I've enjoyed it.
That's Brit on a Bull, Joe Grady. He's working at an Anningie station. He was speaking with Charles Geary at the recent Hearts Range Rodeo. Let's head now to Borroloola. The Borroloola Bushmen's Carnival is on all this weekend. The rodeo will be on. Community member Jasper Dando is there. Jasper, how are things looking out at Borroloola right now?
It's looking pretty busy. There's a few competitors getting around. It's beautiful, cool weather. Fair bit of wind getting around, keeping everything cool. It's pretty lovely days, to be honest.
So you've already had the camp draft running for a couple of days now?
Yeah, so the camp draft has started on Wednesday, and what's today? Today's Friday, so yeah, third day of camp drafting.
It sure is Friday. How's the rest of the weekend looking? What other events have you got going on out there at Borroloola?
So we've got camp drafting on for the rest of today and then half of Saturday. I think we'll be finished camp drafting by about lunchtime on Saturday, and then we'll kick into the starting of the rough stock events in the rodeo on Saturday afternoon into the evening. And then Sunday is all day. We have timed events, which is your roping and your bulldogging and those sorts of things, barrel racing, gymkhana, and then Sunday sort of afternoon will be the remaining of the rough stock.
The Borroloola rodeo is a little bit different to others, isn't it? It's a bit more of an old school bush rodeo.
Yeah, I'd probably say it's one of the last surviving old school bushman rodeos. A lot of rodeos these days have shied away from the roping and the bulldogging and the that sort of style stuff, where we sort of Borroloola bulldogging is pretty important and a pretty big event here. All the locals love getting around it, and the locals all jump in and they all ride in the rodeo, and it's not as trim and proper as your sort of professional rodeos, but I can guarantee you everyone's going to hook in and have a crack.
Are you having a crack at anything yourself, Jasper?
I'm not riding anything or anything, but I'll be one of the rodeo clowns bullfighting in there on Saturday night and Sunday.
So is there still space if anyone wants to head along this weekend?
Yeah, there's plenty of camping spots, plenty of places to roll out a swag or caravan. There's no powered sites, but there's plenty of unpowered room.
What's your sell then, Jasper, if you want to coax a few more people into coming out this weekend? Give me the big sell.
Oh, I can guarantee you'll never see a rodeo like Borroloola. Guarantee it. Bucket list option.
Jasper, thanks for your time on the Country Hour this afternoon. Hope the weekend goes really well.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Jasper Dando there out at Borroloola, where the Bushman's Carnival is on this weekend. That's all the time we've got on the Country Hour today. Happy Friday. My name's Fiona Broom. Thanks for keeping me company during the week. Matt Brand will be back on your radio on Monday. Never fear, he will be back in the hot seat next week. Have a lovely weekend. Keep safe and keep it rural.